Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Afternoon, and welcome to the start of the summer season of Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. To kick off our season, I am so pleased to have fellow host and my good friend, Katie Kiefer, on the show today to talk about her new book, What's the Matter with Meat? Katie, a meat eater herself.
Yes, I am.
We're just going to throw that right out there to start. Offers a comprehensive look at the industrialized meat system, both at home and abroad, and the negative effects it has on our health, environment, and well-being. Katie, welcome to the show. And I just got a pin with the book cover on it and a little bow.
Your badge.
My badge. I'm so excited about this.
It's bunting. I like to call it that.
I don't know what that means, but I love it.
Yeah, I know. It's the fabric actually has little cuts of meat on it.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't that so special?
That is so special.
That was the most genius part of my entire marketing scheme, which otherwise has basically amounted to zero.
Well, the show.
Right. Yes, this show and yes. Hopefully a few more.
Right.
But yes, on other networks even, possibly.
Ooh, we're hoping.
Crazy. We're hoping. Fingers crossed. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, it should be because I want to start out by saying, obviously, congratulations
on publishing this book.
And I have to say, I found it to be so informative and most importantly, totally approachable and engaging and perfect for anyone who wants to learn more about where the majority of our meat comes from. And even for experts, it's just so, it was very well done.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I wanted it to be a primer. I think that the meat industry has traditionally shrouded itself in secrecy. Mm-hmm. And it's only been in the last 10 years or so that, you know, organizations like PETA and Mercy for Animals have been publishing these ghastly videos of, you know, animal cruelty and so forth. And really, you could almost date that back to the Westland Hallmark mm-hmm. episode, which was, I'm trying to think when that was, maybe around 2007. And this was a viral video that showed downer cattle, animals that had been taken off of the truck that they were transported in, and they were not in good shape. And there were a number of animals, or at least one that was captured on video, where the animal collapsed, and the handlers, the people who were working at the plant, were seen prodding it with electric prods. I think they even stuck a prod up its butt.
Yeah.
You know, just like appalling conditions and cruelty, and that sparked an outrage, and the USDA shut the plant down, and they never reopened. They never recovered from that. So,
and
also, I think a huge amount of meat was recalled as a result of that video.
Not surprising. I know I typically find some of PETA's, for instance, their work and their like billboards to be very annoying. Very annoying. But in this case, I think it does shed has in the past shed really important light on some of the kind of atrocities that really go under the radar.
I think, you know, annoying as they may be, and certainly the gadfly that they have been in the side of the meat industry has brought about significant change in animal welfare.
Yeah.
And without those, people would continue to think that animals are being raised on pasture and
bucolic.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Farms.
You know, frolicking about.
My one vegan friend would be very annoyed to hear that I'm trash talking PETA a little bit. But I've got one.
Yeah. Well, you know,
she's
we
great.
All have one.
Yeah. I love her. We all have one, unfortunately.
No, I mean, I am a card-carrying carnivore. I've always really enjoyed meat. I worked as a butcher for a while when I was younger, when I was in the culinary business. Yeah, and that's really where I got my interest, strangely enough. I was really drawn to the whole meat industry. I don't know why.
Yeah. And One thing led to another. Well, I was going to ask. I mean, you've been, we have similar shows, food policy mm-hmm. and industry shows, and you've been doing this for a lot longer than I have. So in kind of covering all of these food system issues, I'm wondering what prompted you to select this particular topic to write a book about.
I was actually commissioned to write this.
Ooh, how fancy.
I know. Well, I owe it all to Patrick Martins, who, you know, started the Heritage Radio Network, uh-huh. and who is the proprietor of Heritage Foods USA. And what happened was that my publisher, which is called Reaction Books in London, they publish a lot of single subject books and about different food products, ice cream, salt, fish, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then last year they launched a new series called Food Controversies. So this is one of probably what will end up being about 10 books in the series, but they include snack food, junk food, meat. I can't remember what the other titles are going to be, but mine is the most recent that's rolled out.
I want to write a book.
Well, you may want to, and you probably can. Don't expect to make any money. I mean, I basically wrote this book for free. And I think that a lot of people, I mean, I'm hoping that it will be sort of my gateway to writing the next book with a publisher that pays me more.
Yeah.
And for the bona fides that it, you know, endows me with as a published author, for some
Absolutely.
Reason that still carries weight with people.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, and this is not just any book. It's really, like I said, it is really well done. And I've written I've read a lot of, you know, books about the food industry. Okay. So let's get into this. Let's get into this. Who are the major players? Let's kind of set the stage. I like to do that in the beginning of all my shows.
Sure.
Who, when we talk about kind of the industrialized meat system, who are the major players, the dominant players that kind of, are responsible?
Well, in this country, but we can talk about the five production centers that I profile in the book. But in this country, it is Cargill, JBS, National, and...
Tyson.
Yeah. And then that's the cattle, but Tyson also crosses over into chicken and some pork. There's Smithfield, of course, which is the big kahuna in the pork industry. There's Hormel.
Are they Chinese?
They are now owned by a Chinese company, putatively called a Chinese company. It's actually a company that it was originally bought by Shuang Hui. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, Shuang Hui morphed into something called the WH Group. And then it was made clear that the WH Group was actually somehow deeply connected to the Chinese government. But that is true of a lot of Chinese industry. So it's not particularly unusual that it has industrial ties, only insofar as we have rather strict laws on the books about governments buying agricultural land in this country. So
we don't really like that. Yeah,
not really. Yeah. I mean, I've actually been researching another article about that, and I thought that it was like much more rampant than it is. But what really is happening is that banks are buying agricultural land for pension funds, hedge funds, and stuff like that. That's another topic.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's those guys. So let's see. JBS owns Pilgrim's Pride, which is a big chicken company. There are four big chicken companies. Those are Tyson, Pilgrim's Pride, Sanderson, and why can't I remember the fourth one? Because I'm slightly senile. But that's basically... Oh, Purdue. Duh. Yeah. So those are the big players. So basically what I'm saying is that each one of these three meat categories is controlled by...
Chicken, poultry, pork.
Yeah.
Or chicken,
poultry,
cattle.
Pork and cattle each have basically four major players with some crossover, obviously. And those major players control roughly 80% of all the processing and distribution of those categories.
Wow.
Yeah. That's serious, serious market consolidation. And it's had a very negative impact on farmers and ranchers across the country. In fact, there's a lot of noise in the cattle and in the poultry markets right now. There are two class action suits against the big four poultry producers alleging price fixing,
Yeah.
That's what happens when you have a monopoly.
Yeah.
So price fixing for the grocery stores or the grocery distributors, as well as price fixing for the actual growers. And the same is true. There's the Attorney General in New Mexico is looking into price fixing allegations from cattle producers in his region, because there's a lot of cattle running on those New Mexican ranges.
So you talk about another one of the issues or kind of realities of all three, types of industries being vertical and horizontal integration. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us some of the kind of effects of that? Like, is it just furthers their control over the market, all aspects of the market?
Oh, absolutely. Indisputably. It also has a very negative impact on rural economies. And here's why. See, when these industries were less integrated, less monopolized, you would have, for example, in a town that had a meatpacking plant, you might have a bunch of different farmers growing their animals. You'd have maybe two processing plants if it's in a heavy duty, you know, animal agricultural setting. You'd have feed mills. You'd have farmers growing the grain. You'd have people working those feed mills. You'd have people working in processing. You'd have a whole range of jobs that kind of propped that town up. What happened when these industries, and this started with the poultry industry and has been followed by the pork industry, when those companies began to consolidate and integrate, it meant that they put a lot of those workers out of business by, they would, for example, if you were the kind of farmer who raised chicks, you wouldn't have a market for your chicks anymore because they would be coming directly from the company. If you were a farmer who raised grain, that company would not be buying grain from you because they would be buying, in some cases, like Smithfield, growing their own grain. Mm-hmm. And that might come locally. That might be a contract. It might be a lease. But whatever it is, it's not supporting the same wide swath of people working in the towns.
And then are the growers part of the vertical integration, or do they
very much so
separate?
Yeah, no. The growers are kind of key to it. The vertical integration has allowed these companies to, instead of actually growing the birds themselves, they contract with farmers to grow the birds. And by contracting with the farmers, they set all of the prices. So the farmer, instead of being able to compete with other farmers on the market, mm-hmm, for the quality of his birds, he's absolutely bound to take the price, whatever the price is, and which he does not know in advance, from that integrator.
Wow.
So it would be like a Tyson or a Purdue or somebody like that.
So their hands are tied.
Absolutely. I mean, this can be read in much greater detail, both in the book, but also especially in Chris Leonard's great book, The Meat Racket. Which gives a whole history of the Tyson family and the development of the way the poultry industry functions now.
But we're not here to plug his book.
No, we're not. But I will always plug Chris Leonard's book. He's a great guy. But secondly, that book is so good, and you learn so much about farming in America.
So let's kind of paint the picture of what these farming practices look like, just broadly speaking. Let's take it industry by industry. So if you were to kind of get a snapshot of what it looks like. From like a cattle processing plant, like a chicken growing, you know, growers and processing, mm-hmm, and pork.
Well, the chicken and themes. Chicken and pork basically function the same way with this contract growing. So what happens is that a guy signs a contract with an integrator like a Tyson or a Smithfield. And then the company says to him, okay, you have to have this particular type of dwelling for these animals, and they write the specs essentially for what that house is going to look like. And then
and I'm assuming they don't really go above and beyond when writing those specs to prioritize animal welfare and feed.
Because the idea is to cram as many animals in as you can. It sort of depends on whether you're doing, if you're an egg laying guy, which I don't know much about the egg business, but that's where the battery cages came in, where everybody got so wound up about the battery cages, which are truly horrible.
Really, really small cages.
Yeah, they're really tiny. They're like 17 square inches. So a bird literally cannot stretch its wings.
Right.
And it certainly can't move around. And it's very similar to what we did to pigs, which was to put them into either a gestation crate or a farrowing crate. And so in those cases, and this is also very common, and as you know, a lot of companies have now, due to public pressure, have committed to phasing out things like battery cages and, mm-hmm, phasing out gestation and farrowing crates. Now, the advantage to a farmer for those, especially with pigs, is that you can really easily calibrate exactly the amount of feed and nutrients that your animal is getting. You minimize the infant mortality because pigs tend to roll over on their piglets.
And
it's gross, but it's just what happens.
It's a real bummer.
Yeah, it's a real bummer for the piglets, especially. But you know, the thing is that if an animal has enough space, this isn't likely to happen. But if it's in a sort of more confined space than it is. So there's a lot of finger pointing about group housing, whether or not that's successful. But the reality is that pigs do better in group housing than they do in a farrowing crate or a gestation crate. So the gestation crate means that the farmer is like exactly monitoring the amount of food and water that this animal is taking in for optimum health of the piglets, right? And but she can't move around. She can just stand in her stall. That's all she can do. And then when she's in the farrowing crate, she's on one side, and the piglets, which need more warmth, are sort of off to the side. And then they can come and suckle when they need to, but they are protected from the size and bulk of the mommy. So, but these are for pigs especially, and this is why, you know, I'm kind of lax about other forms of protein, about, you know, beef and chicken, but I will not buy commercial pork. I just can't bring myself to, because the pigs are basically as smart as a 3-year-old child.
Yeah.
And there have been studies that show pigs can learn things like how to play a computer game. They can manipulate a joystick. I've seen that film.
Wow.
So these are intensely sociable, intensely curious, sentient animals that if you are planning on eating them, you should really want them to have the best possible life. I think that's just kind of, you know, a moral obligation.
Yeah.
And while I understand the impetus to make cheap meat, and I also understand that Americans demand it, I think that you know, those particular animals really need to be got a break. They need group housing. They need stimulation inside the pens. I mean, that's the other thing, is that they're, you know, they become quite abusive to one another when they have nothing to do, when they don't have enough mental stimulus, like things to play with and things to do. Then they start biting each other and, you know, chewing each other's ears and tails off.
How do they do that if they're in, you know, if they're in,
if they're not in a crate? Yeah. Okay. Right. I mean, they're not always...
If they're overcrowded in a confined environment.
Yeah. I mean, for a sow, yes. But for other pigs, pigs that are not breeders are not in a crate. Not all pigs are in a crate. Only the ones that are making babies.
Oh, right.
So the other pigs are all sort of squished together in a pen. And if there's nothing for them to do, they will resort to beating the crap out of each other. And that's what, and chickens do the same thing.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
What about cattle?
Cattle, they have a better... I mean, up until they go to the feedlot, I'd say on the whole that they are in better shape. They mostly grow up on pasture or with some forage. You know, they can't, obviously, in, you know, winter weather, you don't want all your cows out in the field. Like, for instance, we just had a terrible blizzard in the Great Plains in Kansas, and thousands of head of cattle were lost because of this, you know, 2 feet of snow, freezing temperatures. Meanwhile, very muddy, sloppy underneath.
Yeah.
And they haven't counted how many animals they have lost.
Yikes.
But it was significant. And this is right on the heels of the wildfires they had in March. So it's really been a tough
But
tough
global winter. Warming doesn't exist. So it's fine.
Yeah, right.
It's totally
exactly.
fine.
Yes.
So they're better.
So
their conditions
better,
are better.
Yeah,
I think of cattle. I think of the confined animal feeding operation
right.
that you talk a lot about in your book.
That happens at the very end of the cow's life. Now, I mean, the fact is that because of the way we have manipulated genetics and also the way we use drugs to speed growth, whether it's antibiotics or beta agonists.
We're going to talk about that in a minute.
The animals grow a lot faster than they used to. So typically a beef cow will go to slaughter around between 11 and 13 months. So they will spend the last couple of months maximum on grain. And that's what give them the delicious extra, you know, intramuscular marbling that Americans have become so fond of. You know, a nice marbled piece of meat is usually a pretty tender, delicious, juicy
thing.
It's
real good.
Yeah, right. But that comes at a cost. And the cost is, first of all, the grain. And that's why we grow so much corn and soy in this country, not just to feed cattle, but also to feed pigs and chickens, but still.
Yeah.
And then also, it's not really the optimum diet for cattle. And so there's always a kind of equation going on within the feedlot to try to make sure that the cow does not eat too much grain that causes acidosis in the rumen, which then causes it not to eat at all, and then it doesn't gain weight. So it's
negative health effects.
Very
for the,
tricky.
Yeah.
Very tricky.
So they
them.
Grow up a lot, like mostly on pasture, and then they go to
the feedlot.
Feedlot,
yeah.
And the feedlot, aka a CAFO, typically.
Right, exactly. Concentrated area feeding operation.
And then when are they slaughtered on site at the CAFO?
Sometimes.
Okay.
It depends, but not usually. I think usually they're transported to a slaughtering plant because you'd have to... A slaughterhouse processes, a big one, will process as many as 4,000 cattle in a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is.
It's breathtaking.
It is.
Yeah.
My breath was just taken away.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So I visited a plant like that in Fort Collins, and they do 4,000 a day. And that's in 2 8-hour shifts.
Jeez.
Yeah.
How many workers were
sold? You know, I don't remember. But it was a very large fabrication floor, for sure. But the speed and the engineering with which they have figured out how to deconstruct an animal is just incredible. And by the way, you think 4,000 is a lot for cattle. They can do 16,000 pigs in a day.
Jeez.
Yeah.
And the way you broke it down in the book was it really kind of gave me pause. You know, I am an aggressive meat eater. I love it. You know, I try to make responsible choices with regard to the type of meat that I eat.
Sure.
But, you know, I think it's really important for somebody who chooses to eat meat to have, you know, insight into how an animal is raised and slaughtered and, you know, why eating responsibly raised meat is so important. But that gave me pause reading how a cow is processed.
Well, the main thing is, I mean, and this is where Dr. Temple Grandin has been such an incredible force for good.
And who is that?
Temple Grandin is a professor of animal studies at Colorado State University. I think it's Colorado State. It's an agricultural school. And she's autistic. And her autism has allowed her somehow to understand how animals process information in a way that is much more accurate than anybody else has. And so back in the 1990s, she was approached, believe it or not, by McDonald's. Because what was happening was that cattle were going through the slaughtering process as it existed, and they were coming out with a lot of lesser quality meat. And the reason it was lesser quality is because the animals were so stressed as they went into the slaughterhouse. And that was a result of very poor animal handling practices, which were endemic to the industry. People really didn't know. And Temple Grandin broke down. She behaved as if she were a cow herself. Huh. And she had observed their behavior so accurately for so many years that she understood that the things that frightened them were the things that were making them stressed out and releasing all this cortisol into their bloodstream and resulting in tough meat and what they call dark cutters. It makes them very dark in color. And so you can't really sell that meat as a whole muscle cut. It has to go into ground and you lose your profit margin there.
Okay.
So anyway, McDonald's hired her to figure out how to design better animal handling protocols. And what she did was create something called the serpentine, which is a track that the animals follow that makes them feel like they're going in a circle. Because that is, for whatever reason, that is what their natural behavioral pattern is. So instead of going in a circle, they go in a serpentine, but they think it's a circle. And then at the end of the serpentine, and they're one at a time, they're in single file. At the end of the serpentine is a box, and they step into the box, and this platform comes up, and then the sides squeeze in, and that helps to calm the animal. And then it goes through this little chute, and there's a guy on the other side.
He doesn't know what's coming.
And if it works right, it is really a brilliant system because the animal feels nothing. It has a tremendous blow of pressure. It's a hydraulically operated 6-inch captive bolt stunner is what it's called. And it basically stuns the animal to the point of insensibility, at which point they will stick it in the jugular and the animal bleeds out in a couple of seconds.
After it's hung by the hoof, you said.
Yes. By the ankle. They slip a hook through it. But it doesn't, I don't believe that it feels that. I know it's awful, but I mean, we're killing the animals. So, I mean, one must, if you're going to eat meat, you have to accept this is what happens.
Exactly.
This is what happens. And you've got to make your peace with that. And you just have to hope that this particular facility, whatever it may be, is one that takes that all of those protocols very seriously.
Was that widely adopted after her research came out?
It has been widely adopted.
Well, that's good.
Particularly in the larger plants, which have the money in order, you know, to do this. And it's been adopted worldwide, I might add. People all over the world have, and I'll tell you something else really cool about Temple Grandin.
Yeah.
Not to get too off at the topic here, but when Temple devised this system, the serpentine and the whole sort of like the thing, the platform coming up, and the animal being ridden in on that little platform with a little gentle pressure on the sides, she did not want anyone to make money off of that. So she published the plans on her website so that everyone could access them.
That's awesome.
Right?
Yeah.
She's an amazing, amazing woman.
Yes, that
you
is
need to see that documentary on her, or the you know, biopic with Claire Danes.
Oh, I've seen it.
Oh, that's who she is.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you have to see it.
I will see it. I will see it. I'm like, I've seen it. I've totally seen it. Please, Katie.
Of course you have.
Of course I have. I'm an expert.
You know, she's the one who gave me, she gave me the tour around that Fort Collins plant.
Oh, that would be, it would really be an incredible thing to see.
It was, that's why I was able to describe the slaughtering process so accurately, because of course I had notes from it, but I also, frankly,
I've never forgotten it.
I mean, it was really something.
Okay, so the book talks a lot about, obviously, the negative consequences of this system of meat production that is so dominant in our marketplace today. And all of the themes were very interrelated. And one of the things that you talk a lot about is the use of antibiotics. So I want to kind of break down for our listeners, in what ways are they currently administered, in what species, and, you know, who is responsible for doing it?
This has been an issue going back. I think it was probably in the late 50s that they made the discovery that the use of low-dose antibiotics actually not only – this is as CAFOs or, you know, concentrated area feeding operations, no matter what the animal – as that system ramped up, they needed to find a way to protect their animals from disease because they were in such confined quarters. So they started with the low dose of antibiotics as a prophylactic against illness. But then they discovered that – and this is not completely understood to this day, that these low-dose antibiotics also promoted growth. It promoted, you know, muscle growth in the animals. And, of course, that's what you want because we're eating the muscles, right? Mm-hmm. So then it became like, whoa, that really took off.
Because, I'm assuming faster.
Yeah, way faster. And that's why we have, for example, cattle that come to slaughter weight at 11 to 13 months instead of 18 to 22. And pigs, which used to take a year, now take 6 months. So, and chickens, this partly because of antibiotics and partly because of genetic manipulation, chickens now take 7 weeks from hatch to slaughter.
What are they naturally?
26.
That is, like,
I mean, the
creepy. That is very, there's something very disconcerting about that.
Well, I don't know if you've been seeing, but there are, there's quite a movement amongst sort of the Humane Society of the United States and other groups to, and even the chicken industry itself is beginning to roll back that very, very fast growing model, because it's, for one thing, the breasts of these chickens are getting way too big and they develop something called Woody breast syndrome, where the muscle is actually like hard.
Oh.
And it must be very uncomfortable for the animal, but it also means that it diminishes the value of the breast,
yeah.
You know, because breast meat is typically quite expensive, right?
I don't know why. I think it's like the worst part of the animal.
That's
personally.
Called marketing, darling.
Yeah, I'm like, who wants a chicken breast? Not me. Ugh. I'm all about the thighs.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a thigh girl.
Yeah, betcha. But anyway, so they discovered this, and then in 1977, I think it was, the FDA made some attempt to start rolling this set back as they began to see what's called multi-drug resistance in pathogens, common illnesses, common foodborne illnesses.
You said that, you know, the industry kind of started to sound the alarm as early as the 70s, and I mean, I'm going to ask if there have been major strides made in this area. I'm going to go on a limb and say no.
Actually, no. I'm going to say yes, because not so much in the United States and other areas, but the European Union, I think by the 1994, 98, had in Denmark, in the Netherlands, and maybe in France. No, not in France. But Denmark and the Netherlands had basically stopped using prophylactic, because they mostly grow pork there, prophylactic use of antibiotics altogether. And as a result, their multi-drug resistant bacteria load began to diminish. So the proof was in the pudding.
Right.
But American growers or American meat companies have really stupidly and I don't know how to say this in strong enough terms, you know, just stubbornly refused to accept the science. And it's kind of like not accepting climate change.
Right.
It's been proven over and over and over in multitudes of studies that excessive use of antibiotics, whether in a medical setting like a hospital or in an animal setting like a, you know, like a contract farmer, it produces multi-drug resistant pathogens. Now, we have four major foodborne illness groups mm-hmm. in this country. Salmonella, Listeriosis, Campylobacteriosis, and E. coli. The big jack-in-the-box...
What is the...
E. coli is Escherichia coli.
Oh, no, I know that. The capillaris.
Oh, Campylobacteriosis.
That one.
Campylobacter is actually very, very common and primarily found in poultry.
Okay.
Salmonella also ubiquitous. I mean, frankly, we all have these organisms in our bodies already, and yeah. most of them are harmless to us. Mm-hmm. But what happens with these multi-drug resistant, either if you get sick from food, usually you are going to get one of these, typically nowadays, mm-hmm. you are going to get one of these multi-drug resistant strains. So for example, the Jack in the Box outbreak in 1994, which spurred an absolute change and upheaval in the way meat is inspected yep. and, you know, basically kept safe.
That was litigated by Bill Marler, I've had on the show before. He's fascinating.
He's a great guy. Yeah. I've had him on a lot as well. I really like him a lot. And I read his food safety blog a lot. But anyway, he litigated that. And in that case, Jack in the Box had deliberately undercooked its hamburgers because they were getting too tough and dry. And so something like 600 or 800 people became ill, mostly in the Northwest, and all at once from, at least 4 children died. Maybe it was 9. I don't have the figure right in front of me, but it was a significant number of kids. And that really got people's attention. And it was discovered that they all suffered from the same serotype of E. coli. It was called 0157H7. And 0157H7 happens to be one of these multi-drug resistant bacteria. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't necessarily use antibiotics to treat E. coli, which is one of the things that makes it so deadly when it's in this, you know, in this sort of more virulent, amped up form. But in any case, once they figured that out, that was in the 1990s, then around 2000... there was a lot of pushback on the industry about using antibiotics, and the industry was like, we have to do it. Meat prices will rise exponentially. It's not possible to, you know, grow meat the way we grow it without using antibiotics. And in fact, I even gave 2 talks to the Animal Agricultural Alliance and to the National Institute on Animal Agriculture just about this, and maybe 7 years ago.
Okay.
That was when they thought I was like on the side of the meat industry.
So sneaky.
Yeah.
So sneaky.
It was very sneaky of me. And now I'm basically, you know, blackballed. But, oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Wait till they get a load of this book.
I don't even know it's coming.
They don't. Yeah. I haven't sent one. I must say I should have sent review copies to some of their journals, but I did not because I just didn't want to deal with the pushback from them. But anyway, to cut this long story shorter, what happened in 2011 is that the FDA finally issued 2 guidances about how you could use antibiotics in an animal agricultural setting, and what antibiotics you could use. In other words, the ones that were medically important, like cephalosporins, mm-hmm. Had to be taken out of that rotation. They weren't allowed to use those anymore. But the other ones, like doxycycline, all the tetracyclines are still in animal agriculture. Penicillin is still in agriculture.
What did the regulation kind of, or was
it's
it a regulation?
It's not a regulation.
Or was
That's
it a guideline?
The thing. It's a guidance. So that, and then the other one was that that there had to be a veterinary feed directive, meaning that veterinarians had to actually write a prescription for these drugs.
Who did it currently?
No one, the farmer himself, the grower himself. He would just buy them over the counter, basically.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's why this has become such a problem. And the FDA does not have the resources or the USDA to actually monitor this compliance. So first it was up to the drug companies to change what's called off-label use so that they couldn't use it for growth promoting.
Does the guidance, quote guidance, refer or relate only to growth, or is it also prophylactics?
Also prophylactic, yes. They're supposed to really only be treating these animals if they're sick.
Okay.
But both are, I don't know about the growth promoting because they've taken that off-label use off of the drug companies have complied with that. But what's happened now is that basically the FDA is just now, I actually put this in my show last week in my news segment, they are just now conducting a survey to see what kind of compliance has happened since those directives came into, they were developed in the 2011. Also, Barack Obama signed a whole thing about, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't read it because I don't have my glasses.
Okay.
Never mind. But thank you for giving me a cheat sheet there.
I think the regulation is just for growth.
Maybe. Yeah. But anyway, the point is that not only did Barack Obama sign a law into effect about the regulation of the use of antibiotics, but in 2017, that's this year, the veterinarian feed directive goes into effect and they can no longer buy this stuff over the counter.
So it has to go through the
vet. So it now has to go through the vet. Now, in Europe, it's been going through the vet forever.
They always have things figured out. Oh, they're so much from a food perspective. Oh.
Well, what they are is they are public minded. They are not as greedy as we
are.
Like,
what's that?
Yeah. I mean, they actually think about public health. I mean, the World Health Organization, Dr. Margaret Chan, a couple of years ago said, you know, we are basically barreling down a road to post-antibiotic apocalypse.
Yeah.
And until hospitals and animal agriculture gets their act together, you know, we're really in danger of dying from the most minor thing.
Yeah. I just think that's a message that kind of... it doesn't resonate yet with people. I don't really know why. I think that people just don't really accept it or can't wrap their heads around it. Because if they did, they really knew the implications, we would have massive change very quickly. Okay, so we have to take a really quick commercial break.
Oh, okay.
And hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we're going to talk more about this in terms of...
Yeah, there's one more thing I want to say about it. So
yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. We're going to talk.
We'll do the sponsor drop. Thanks, Vitor. And then we'll come right back with my last point about antibiotics.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I am speaking with Katie Kiefer about her new book, What's the Matter with Meat? Okay, you had one more point about antibiotics before we moved on.
Yes, and my point is this. Most people think when we talk about antibiotics in our food system, they think that the antibiotics are actually on the meat. And I want it to be clear that they are not on the meat. Animals are weaned off the antibiotics. It's not in the meat. Okay. You don't have to worry that you're eating antibiotics. That's the last,
well, then
you know,
how do we become resistant to them?
We are not resistant. It's the pathogens that live on the outside of the meat that are resistant. And those pathogens are transferred by poor handling practices, undercooked meat, hamburger, you know, any kind of ground meat has got all those nooks and crannies where the what was on the exterior is now on the interior. Same thing with needle tenderized. Don't ever buy needle tenderized meat, ever.
Yeah.
And if you're going to buy ground meat, if you can buy it at a butcher and make sure that they're grinding it right fresh there, that would be your best bet.
You have a point in the book that says never wash your chicken, which was one of the first things we learned when we were in culinary school when we got to the chicken portion of the curriculum. But B, I think, is really misunderstood. I think a lot of people still do it.
Oh, yeah.
And, the repercussion could be that you splash some salmonella all over your countertop.
Absolutely. On your sponge, and then you wipe it all over your counters. You wipe it, you know, I mean, it really is. You must not wash your chickens.
Also, because it makes no sense.
They will cook. I mean, any bacteria will die from the cooking.
Yeah.
So, you really want to avoid that.
Okay. So what about, is that the main issue is, okay, actually.
You mean about multi-drug resistant bacteria?
No.
And a post-apocalyptic, a post-antibiotic apocalypse.
Just that.
Another one of my favorite writers, Maren McKenna, has written a couple of books about this, and I highly recommend them.
So beyond kind of antibiotic resistance, among the animals, and the transmission to humans, obviously.
Mm. Yeah.
What are some of the other results, negative health consequences,
For the animal?
Well, no, for the farm workers. And also maybe the population, the general population, beyond antibiotic resistance.
One of the key things that I think people should be aware of is that methicillin resistant Staphylococcus aureus, otherwise known as MRSA.
What does that mean?
Okay. It developed it's methicillin is a penicillin drug, right?
Okay.
Which was used to treat staphylococcus or staph infections.
Mm-hmm. Look at you just dropping all these terms, Katie.
I'm telling you, I practice.
I clearly didn't. I couldn't pronounce one of the four major pathogens, so it's embarrassing.
Not at all. I did spend a long time researching this stuff.
Oh, yeah, you did write the book. Yeah.
And also, I've talked to a lot of scientists about it. I found this a very alarming. In fact, I did weeks, if not months, of programming on this station about antibiotic resistance to the point where Erin Fairbanks, when she was the director, came to me one day and she was like
enough.
Okay, enough with that. Can we go on to another topic, perhaps?
You're like, well, at least you're listening.
Yeah, right. But I think that's enough of a consequence. I mean, you know, the rapid growth promotion in general doesn't really hurt the animals. So it's that, and the fact that they're prevented from getting common diseases that would sweep through a barn or a house normally is a good thing. I think that there are other drugs that have deleterious effects that we in the United States use quite liberally and many other countries have banned, and that is a class of drug called beta agonists. And those are also used as growth promotion. And I suspect that there will be a considerable uptick in the use of those drugs as antibiotics are further phased out of animal agriculture in the coming months and years.
How do we as a consumer know if we're eating meat that was treated or over-treated with antibiotics?
We don't. I mean, these drugs are withdrawn before the animal goes to slaughter for usually up to 2 weeks. They will wean them off of any antibiotics, really indeed any drug, so that there is very little drug residue left in their system. That's an FDA mandate and they have to do that.
Okay.
So again, as I say, there are no antibiotics in the meat itself. That doesn't exist.
So it's mostly, you can maybe assume that if an animal was raised on pasture for the majority of its life and maybe not sent to a CAFO, kind of, finished on grain, but was like raised on a smaller mid-sized farm, not overcrowded. They wouldn't need to use excessive antibiotics.
Absolutely.
And,
but that doesn't mean that they don't ever. I mean,
well, if an animal gets sick, it gets sick.
Yeah, exactly. And but I think in general, I mean, antibiotics are expensive.
Yeah.
So for somebody who is not engaged in a CAFO
setting,
that's
a really good point. That is a really good point.
Yeah. They're not gonna use them unless
right.
they need to.
There's not. Yeah.
And that's another reason why farm raised meat that you buy in the farmers market seems so colossally and incredibly expensive. And that's because the animals take longer to grow to slaughter weight. It takes a lot longer. It takes a lot more feed. It takes a lot more labor to get them to that slaughter weight. So so that price is reflected mm-hmm. in that, you know, in the extended husbandry that is necessary to keep them going.
I want to talk a shift tax a little bit
sure.
and talk about, well, and talk about food fraud.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun chapter.
Which was something that I was surprised that, you know, would be in this book and would relate to the meat industry. I usually think of the usual suspects of olive oil, honey, even fish, but not necessarily
fish.
Yeah, not necessarily meat, though. So what does that look like?
Well, what prompted that is my publisher is British, and about, I think it was in 2013, they had a major discovery of horse meat in cheap ground meat.
God, that is so upsetting to
me. It was a little disturbing. Anyway, it was a really fascinating chapter to write. The research was really interesting, and it points to the opacity of our supply chain, meaning that, you know, when you're, especially if you buy processed foods, now when you go into the grocery store, it's, I mean, I won't say it doesn't happen because it does, because like this happened in Tesco's in England, which mm-hmm. is, you know, a widely known and large grocery store chain, sort of mid-level, I would say, kind of like a Gristedes, I would think, mm-hmm. You know, slightly funky, but, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what happened was the Irish Food Safety Authority tested some meat from Tesco and they discovered the presence of horse meat in it and a little bit of pork. So then they broadened.
Just for good measure.
Right. Then they broadened. Well, because the beef prices have been quite high because the supply got very tight. So they began testing more widely and they discovered that it was in many, many, many grocery store chains. And then they realized that it was in all these processed foods. Now, I'm trying to remember. This is over a year since I wrote this. So I can't remember whether Tesco's thing was like a cheap processed food with ground meat or whether it was just ground meat per se. But in general, I would say that processed foods are most likely to be the harbor of meat fraud. Because they're covered, you know, it's a processed food, it's meat, it's ground meat, it's, you know, got a lot of sauce on it.
It's watered down, it's, you said?
Well,
sometimes,
I mean,
or like other additives?
Yeah, it just says, you know, like they'll put breadcrumbs or they'll put, you know, some
heavier.
Other kind of filler.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to bulk it up, right? Because then it's cheaper to produce.
And the grocers are doing that.
Well, the manufacturing processors are doing that. It's not, I'm talking about processed foods like a lasagna or a jarred sauce with ground meat in it or something like that.
Okay, but
empanadas.
So this doesn't apply to regular ground meat that you get, just
it could.
Pure ground meat.
It could easily. You know, I don't think it's, they didn't make it clear in any of the research that was like both things mm-hmm. were happening.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it's easier to conceal it when it's in a processed food, right? I mean, mm-hmm. think of how tempting that would be if you were a manufacturer and you're making like a lasagna bolognese and you could put, you know, half a pound of horse meat to every half a pound of beef. Well, your price is just, I mean, your cost just
I don't understand why horse meat is cheap, by the way. They're not... typically very cheap to buy if you want to ride them, but whatever.
Well, that's a whole other topic. I mean, honestly, that really is a whole other topic.
Yeah, it is.
It's I don't know a lot about the horse meat industry. You know, horse meat is still quite popular in Italy, for example. I went to several big markets in Italy when I was traveling there last summer, and they all had a horse meat stall.
Yeah,
there's definitely, and it was on menus a lot.
Really,
the French used to be very fond of it. They seem to be less so now.
Yeah.
Anyway,
gross.
So, food fraud is a $40 billion business worldwide, and it is engaged in by organized crime, mm-hmm. by drug cartels. I mean, it is just, it's a huge business. And so, in the case of this experience in the United Kingdom, these. the fraudulent meat was found to be literally throughout Europe, and it was coming from so many different suppliers and traveling through so many different hands. So like a guy in Romania would sell it to a Polish guy, and the Polish guy would sell it to the, you know, guy in the Netherlands, and the Netherlands guy would turn it into something else and sell it to the French, and then the French would put it in, you know, that's how it worked. And that, I think the point of that chapter is to show that there's very little inspection going on in terms of the way food is sort of moves along that supply chain. And it's really difficult to trace back food fraud because it's such a complex chain that it goes through before it gets to the consumer. We do not at this in this just a sorry about that. We test fish a lot more in this country, but to my knowledge, and I could totally be wrong about this, but to my knowledge, there is no one who has engaged in large scale testing of American meat products.
So we don't know if food fraud is more common in the like in other markets versus domestically.
Right.
Great.
Yeah. No, isn't that reassuring?
Yes. So. one more thing I wanted to talk about before we wrap up, and I could obviously talk,
we could go on.
I know,
and on.
On and on.
I'm telling
on,
you, I'm
on
having so on. Much fun talking about it.
I could just take you through line by line.
Like I actually know this stuff. It's incredible. I did just have to read the book again.
Sorry about that. I did. I loved it.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a year away from looking at it, you know, because of course when you do a project like this, you're like, you have absolutely no perspective whatsoever. So it was really fun to read it again this weekend.
You're like, damn, oh I did a good job.
And it's my hair.
Okay, so I want to talk about like something super uplifting before we wrap up, and that is the industrialized meat systems effect on the workers. You know, it's kind of notorious for being incredibly dangerous, especially specifically for the processing cattle, but also, you know, really kind of taking advantage of its labor force. So can you tell us a little bit more about the labor violations in particular?
Well, there's been a lot of reports from Oxfam, published a huge report about 2 years ago about workers in a poultry industry. And I think the New Yorker just ran a big story about the Case Farm poultry company that was, you know, doing something. I haven't completely read the story yet, so I can't quote it. But basically what happens is this. Meatpacking used to be, you know, processing, butchering, all of that stuff that goes on in a slaughterhouse. That used to be a pretty middle class job, believe it or not.
It was unionized.
It was heavily unionized. It was well paid. I mean, in the 70s, butchers, you know, slaughterhouse workers were making around $20 an hour, which was, if you think about 1970s dollars, that was probably the equivalent of 35 now, right? Mm-hmm. And in Australia, indeed, there are still meatpacking jobs that are worth $32 an hour, but they are struggling to keep hold of their unions. And so what happened in the 80s, when the Reagan administration, and this happened in Britain with the Thatcher administration, that was the era of union busting. And when that started happening, at the same time, these companies were moving their slaughter plants out of urban centers like Chicago or Kansas City, that have typically in the United States been where cattle or whatever was processed, and out into sort of rural communities.
It's so weird that to think of processing happening largely in urban areas.
It used to happen down in the meatpacking district here in New York City, right?
Hence the name.
Yeah.
But it's weird, right?
It is
like
really
you're going to bring the animals into a, you know, a more crowded urban environment to a city and then slaughter them. I mean, I guess it's closer processing to the grocery stores, but it seems
exactly
counterintuitive for some reason.
It does. But so what happened is that a lot of those processing facilities moved way outside of urban centers, and that made it harder for these companies to find workers. So, and as the unions disappeared, then the protections that unions offered made the jobs less attractive to local population. And that's when guest workers, or largely undocumented immigrants at this point, have been imported or solicited to work in those plants. And then what happens there is that there's no union protection or very little. People are expected to work very long shifts. They have pretty good protective gear, but it still remains a very, very dangerous job. And the most dangerous dangerous aspect of it is the speed with which they are required to process these animals. So remember when earlier we were talking about 4,000 cattle a day or 16,000 pigs. It's just remarkable how fast they are expected to produce, to create the same motion over and over again. And that's where you get these crippling neuromuscular injuries that really can basically ruin a person's life. I mean, it will completely distort the skeletal structure of their hands. They develop these tremendous problems with their upper shoulders and neck.
And they don't move them to another part of the line?
Not usually, no. Now, here's another great book to read about that, and that would be Ted Genoway's book, The Chain. Highly recommend that.
Yeah, you said something in the book about, like, workers disappearing into the, like, massive...
That used to happen a lot.
What was that,
though? Into those big meat grinders.
Yeah. Oh,
you know, when they grind meat for, you know, like, huge amounts of meat, which, you know, every plant does, okay. I mean, they're not just grinding, like, a little couple pound chunk. I mean, they'll put stuff hundreds of pounds into these enormous meat grinders. In fact, somebody was killed not that long ago.
It just really,
like 4 or 5 years ago, a guy was cleaning the meat grinder and the machine had not been disconnected and somehow the switch got whatever.
Jesus.
Yeah, that was a lawsuit.
Yeah. Yeah, not to make light of that, but
that was horrible. It has gotten a lot better, but because of the chain speed, it is extremely dangerous. And then there's a lot of abuse going on in terms of, like, not letting people pee. They can't go to the bathroom.
I've read about that.
I mean, there are workers who literally wear diapers
because of the speed,
because they cannot leave the line. Because anything that shuts down the line reduces the profitability of that company, and anything that reduces the profitability of that company is not tolerated. And so, you know, if people shut down the line for safety reasons, for inspection reasons, for having to pee, they will soon find themselves out of a job.
How does a consumer feel okay about purchasing meat? Now that we kind of laid out all of the devastating consequences, just a couple, and I am, you know, everyone's probably like a little bit sufficiently grossed out, right? So, what can we say as fellow to our fellow omnivores to continue them, you know, to encourage them to be so?
I think it really comes down to being aware of the track record of the company from whom you are buying your food. So, you know, for example, I would say, even though I'm not a big, you know, I don't, how do I say this in a way that doesn't, you know, bring down the wrath of God? But for example, Purdue as a company, right? Now, Purdue was right out of the gate, the first one of the big four processors to commit to phasing antibiotics out of their food chain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was a very good thing. And there have been a few other changes. They have different, they've all developed these different organic.
Those are quotation marks around that.
Yeah. I mean, they probably are organic, but they're still confined animals. I mean, they're still, but I think look at the track record of the company, do some research. It's kind of fun. It's kind of interesting, and see what they're doing. What is their environmental footprint? What are they doing to improve their sustainability? How are they, you know, I mean, I know it's hard to look for things like how are they treating their workers, but stuff like the antibiotics is kind of important. And I think also animals that are more or less kept out on patch. I'm a big fan of Nyman Ranch, for example, because they have
bought by Tyson's.
Nyman Ranch is owned by Purdue now.
Purdue, yeah.
But Purdue has only done one thing for them, which is recapitalize them. So they are expanding because their model has been so successful in terms of being able to support family farms and still produce the kind of scale necessary to be a quote-unquote industrial player, i.e. getting your product out into, you know, thousands of supermarkets and into thousands of restaurants.
So I do think it is true that we're kind of moving in the right direction. Industry is moving in the right direction and trying to become more transparent. And to me, that seems like it's largely a result from consumer pressure.
Yes.
And so I think your advice, it sounds like, is to continue to apply that pressure and to be an informed consumer.
Absolutely. Another place, I'll just finish by saying, another place that is applying pressure, believe it or not, is Wall Street. And the reason
that I am very surprised by.
Yeah. And the reason is that these companies need to remain profitable. and a lot of them are publicly traded. And so if they are engaging in practices that either do not meet the needs of the consumer or that have long-term ramifications in terms of sustainability, i.e. water use or land use, that is going to have an impact on the profitability of the company and therefore the shareholder. And so there are a lot of companies, there, not a lot, but there are a number of organizations out there that are putting pressure on these companies to be more mindful about their water usage, figure out how to dispose of their waste more efficiently, and you know, some of the other problems that go along with this.
Where can we find a copy of your book?
Well, I'm hoping that it's in bookstores across the country, but the reality is probably Amazon is your best bet. Okay. Even though I love to support local bookstores, I really haven't checked to see how many of them have ordered it.
All right.
Well, but you can ask your local bookstore to order it.
There you go.
There you go.
Be a consumer who's informed and ask for what they want.
Yeah, and you'll learn everything and much, much more than you wanted to ever know about the meat industry. But, you know, knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. All right, Katie, thank you so much
thank
for
you,
coming
Jenna.
On the show. Katie's book is What's the Matter with Meat? I want to, when we're wrapping up, thank our sponsors, of course, for their generous support. Our show music is by Tim Archer. I want to thank our engineer, Vitor Hirsch. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe. And if you like what you hear, leave us a note in the comments section. Like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook and find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.